This is John Van Eenwick, February 4th, 1995, Psychological Development. This is tapes 2 and 3 of 3. Tape 3 only had 10 minutes on it, so I combined it here.
After he returned, was in the hospital, and when he was in the hospital, he was calling out her mother. And to me, that's a puzzle. I just couldn't imagine how that could be. Except that he's calling out for a type of mother.
Precisely.
Not his biological mother. And yeah. He blocked off the feedback that that mother is, the biological mother was a harmful thing. So he can't recognize.
Well, in one sense, I'd go a little further and say that it's not so much he's blocked off that biological mother, but that he knows from the archetypal awareness within himself, the kind of consciousness, if you will, that there is mothering potential, that such mothering potential exists. But he doesn't know that. All he knows is the objective referent in his environment at the moment.
But that's also where his emotional center is.
Exactly.
And his personality can develop around.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And he's going to have real problems relating to himself.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's why there are only two really bad situations you can get with parents. And that is totally negligent, inadequate parents and totally competent, adequate parents. They're both equally bad. Because if your parents are absolutely everything, then there's not enough... there's not enough discontinuity between expectation and phenomenon to lead you to look somewhere else. You know, most of us, when we get to be about 7 or 8, begin to find surrogate parents because our parents just aren't capable of doing all that parenting requires. And usually it's our parents who induce us to do that. You know, they get us onto teams or into arts or activities where somebody else is teaching us something that they can't teach us, and automatically we connect with that. And then usually by adolescence, we're convinced that our parents are just, you know, we've really been dealt a bad hand. And that's good, because then we're forced to look for it elsewhere. And first we find it in surrogate parents, and then we find it in the next dimension of the archetype, which is institutional parents, schools, something like that. Then in cultural parents, governments, that sort of thing. Then in kind of metaphysical parents, churches, religions, that sort of thing. And we're always getting to the point where those parents eventually are revealed to us as inadequate. And you get to the kind of last dragon phenomenon, you know. Who's the last dragon from whom you're going to learn? And of course the answer is look in the mirror. You know, it's your own archetypal potential that you have to get in touch with at that point. Which is why I think the Buddhists say things like, if you pray and do rituals out of need, you shouldn't be doing them. But if you don't need them anymore, then you can do them. Then it's okay. You know, and it's that sort of paradoxical thing where at that point you are really connected with the essence, and you can take whatever particular form of existence you want. Well, that's, yeah.
There's one thing, kind of go back to what you were talking about. Is there such a thing as a split archetype? Do some people in development have a good mother and a bad mother rather than an archetype that begins with their needs? This sort of split good mother-bad mother phenomenon, can you do that with an archetype? In other words, split it off so there's not one archetype that contains both elements, but rather you've got the good mother archetype over here and the bad mother archetype over here.
I think technically Jung would say that the good mother, bad mother are part of the same archetype, that all archetypes are bipolar.
So a person, we wouldn't see that as someone that was able to just split them off as a form of neuroses or something.
Yeah,
neuroses.
Right.
We wouldn't see.
I think one of the difficulties we always have is seeing the one or the other in the same person.
Exactly. There's some people who aren't able to do that because of developmental reasons.
Right.
Would that be something you've seen in analysis, for instance, of someone who had been so polarized or split that they couldn't combine them into one?
Yeah, I think that's a regular phenomenon. I think that's a part of what would be called normal psychological development, too. The difficulty of integrating the split into the same object.
Right.
Yeah, we all tend to have that trouble.
Yeah, but there's a certain level where it's certainly
oh yeah, yeah. Oh. Those are and analytically, those are for me personally tough cases, because you know who gets to be the bad object, right? You know, right? Okay. You want to? you want to take a break? Let's take a break. We've been sitting for quite a while. Then we'll come back and we'll start the, is through what Jung described as the kind of paradigmatic experience of adult individuation. We've gone over everything now. We've done the synchronic stuff and the early childhood stuff and the formation of the complexes. And now we're going to go into what Jung considered to be normal adult development. And of course, what Jung felt was that childhood development was adequately covered by Freud, interestingly enough, and that he didn't really have to add anything more to that. But that what was inadequately developed was the idea that anything took place after age 10. And he felt that actually there was quite a bit that took place after age 10. And if you read his biography, you can see why. There was a lot going on in his life after age 10. So what we're going to do now is talk about adult development. And we're going to start with childhood development because we've got to lay the groundwork. One of the things that happens early on in our lives, even before we become aware of it, is that we learn to respond to the environment in ways that get us what we want. And that's obviously something that takes place before consciousness ever occurs. Consciousness as we know it, a reflecting consciousness, a deliberating consciousness. But we just have a sense that through the classic Skinnerian behavior modification, conditioned stimuli and unconditioned stimuli, that in fact behavior does become conditioned by what the need is and the gratification of the need. So early on, we learn to fit into our environments. Now, what that means is whether complexes are doing this for us or consciousness is doing it, we are making choices right off the bat. Choices of how to behave, choices of how to respond, choices of how to initiate, choices of how to expand into the environment, choices of how not to expand, how to recede from the environment. And every time we make a choice, we basically give up an option for being. And in giving up that option for being, we invariably go to another point of decision where we make a choice and we give up another option for being. But because the next option for being which we are dropping is somewhat conditioned by the item we dropped earlier on, there comes to be basically a consciously constructed, and consciously, you have to allow me a little latitude here because earlier on in the personality it's not consciously done, but certainly from about age 6 or 7 on when the real stuff starts to kick in, the real heavy stuff starts to kick in, we have a consciously determined personality. And then we have all kinds of personality characteristics that we have neglected to develop at all. And of course, you know that what we're moving towards now is Jung's concept of the persona on the one hand and the shadow on the other. Now, the persona is basically that personality that we put together in order to get along, in order to get by, in order to get on with the environment into which we are born. We learn that certain cries get us what we need and certain others don't. Certain ways of responding get us what we need and certain others don't. I don't know if you've ever been into those wonderful homes where the parents are really, really concerned about the safety of the child and the child is just getting into everything, you know, everything possible. And every time the child begins to move towards something that could be considered at all dangerous, the parents are immediately there and taking care of the child. And it's a conditioned response on the part of both the child and the parent. And then you go into those homes where the parents are really not looking at the kids at all. If the kid wants to fall off the back of the couch, go right ahead. And the kids are really quite well behaved. You know, they don't really extend out too much. It's that kind of thing. It's the two different styles as a result of the environment in which they grow up. And clearly, as we grow older, our personas become more and more complex. So what Jung said of the persona is, it is the collective consciousness of the individual. And what he meant by that is that that personality that we put together reflects what the collective we are in consciously assumes is the way we ought to be. So the persona is a function of collective consciousness.
Could you say that once more?
Yes. What's the that?
I'm curious about the collective consciousness is...
Oh, yeah, okay. Collective consciousness are all those assumptions on the part of the group into which we are placed.
The other's assumptions of us.
It's the other's assumptions of how everybody ought to be.
That we've internalized.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. That when you meet somebody, you say hello. Okay, so I say hello. You know, you shake hands. I shake hands. You know, these are just assumptions. And they're known. I mean, they're not unconscious. People know this. They know that this is the way people ought to be. When somebody does something for you, you should say thank you. If you want something, you should say please. And these are collectively held conscious assumptions that we then learn to go along with. Now, as that occurs, of course, a number of things happen. One, and this is one of the most interesting things, if we get along with the first group that we learn the collective conscious assumptions of, it does not necessarily mean we're going to get along in the next group. So those of you who are kindergarten teachers are well aware of this phenomenon. You get kids who come into your classrooms from all kinds of different families that have all kinds of different collective conscious assumptions about how people should be, and they get into kindergarten, and they're not the same. They suddenly realize this is a new group. This is school. It has its own sets of assumptions about how people ought to be. So the child immediately gets into a conflict between who they are and who they think they have to be, and they learn to be more who they have to be. This is the way it normally occurs. And then this goes on from school to family to, you know, you name it. If I'm a member of a street gang in the inner city, I may have a persona that is totally congruent with my group and totally discordant or discongruent with the rest of society. So here I am doing exactly what I know I have to do in order to fit in with the group to which I belong, and I'm getting arrested for it, you know, when I'm trying to do the right thing. That's sort of a thing. So we have conflicting personae. And of course, this happens even more in multi-ethnic, multi-racial cultures. Remember that Jung wrote his stuff in Switzerland. And if there is a land of uniformity, it is Switzerland. I mean, it is. I learned when I was in Switzerland that the cruelest question you could ask a Swiss, and this should probably not be on the tape because I'll be shot by some Swiss someday because it's totally wrong. Well, they didn't know why. They just knew that they'd been doing it for 400 years and it worked. And it worked perfectly. So who cared why it worked? You know, so that's kind of the Swiss mentality. It's changed radically in the last several years because of immigration and because of increased travel overseas. And so personas are the first things that are up for grabs in adult psychological development. And what happens to us is that because the persona is a function of the collective consciousness, the identity which we put together for ourselves in response to the demands of the environment creates of us a collective identity. It's not us. We are over-skewed in the term of psychic energy, in the sense of psychic energy, into the collective consciousness. Now, if collective consciousness is overemphasized, and through the law of tension of opposites, the archetypes begin to activate the opposite of that, the opposite of collective consciousness is personal, collective personal, unconsciousness. And Jung called the personal unconscious the shadow. And what happens is energy or libido, Jung did not use libido in the sexual sense that Freud did. He used it in the sense of life energy. Energy will run into the opposite, which is the personal unconscious, which is the shadow, which is all that stuff that we have left behind previously. Now, this usually occurs in this culture in adolescence. That's usually where that first begins to hit. Now, when Jung described it, he described it as hitting at middle age, at midlife. And if you, again, look at Switzerland, that's pretty true for Switzerland, and up to about 20 years ago was still true for Switzerland, that it really wasn't until about middle age that you began to really hit the fact that, as Jung said, the persona cracks. It's that old Patti Page song, "Is That All There Is?" You know, "I've lived a good life, and is that all there is?" You know, and you begin to realize there's got to be something more. It's the point at which you become dissatisfied with your job, your career choice. You become dissatisfied with your partner in life. You become dissatisfied with where you live. You become dissatisfied with all of that, and you start seeking a change. And you start doing it in a way that whether you realize it or not, is not only going to be a change per se, but in order for it to be an effective movement into the personal unconscious, away from the collective conscious, it's going to have to be deviant. It's going to have to be bad. It's going to have to be done in the shadows, in the dark. It's going to have to be done where the collective consciousness does not go. Now, again, as I said, I think in American culture, we do that in adolescence. Now, parenthetically, like everything else, the archetype helps us into this process through giving a charge or a valence to images in the environment. And those images in the environment then help us to understand where we've got to go for this instinctual drive towards finding out who we really are, where we have to go through these images. And this is why there is always an element in all cultures that does everything in its power possible to remove those images from the culture. Collective consciousness hates the shadow, because the shadow is the most threatening thing to collective consciousness. So anything, whether it's pornography, whether it's rock music, whether it's images of other customs and practices or other religions or other beliefs or you name it, there's always an element in every collective culture that's trying to get rid of all of those. Because the idea is the problem is the images. And the problem is not the images. The problem is the inner psychological dynamics. So what happens is you eliminate all those images. You know, you ban pornography, and after, or you imprison every drug user. And after 10 to 20 years, you suddenly realize it's still there. It's still happening. You know, attacking the image that carried the projection has not gotten rid of that which was doing the projecting, because the archetype is perfectly happy to move. You want to get rid of that image? Fine, we'll use that image. Because it's an absolute necessity that on the way to finding out who we are, we have to go back and pick up all that stuff we left behind as a result of putting ourselves together in a way that went along with those who we had to survive with. Okay? So that's the shadow. The shadow is the personal unconscious. Now, what happens, says Jung, is as our attention is drawn into the shadow and we begin to live out that shadowy world, that's putting a lot of energy into the personal unconscious. And eventually it gets to the point where there's just too much energy in the personal unconscious. We're living out the shadow too much. Because unfortunately for our simplistic way of viewing things, the collective consciousness that we got totally strung out on also contained some aspects of our personality that were genuine, that really were us. So that saying please and thank you, and of course that's a very basic level of the persona, was actually really who we were. We were polite people. We were considerate people. We really were. So after we've been in the collective, in the personal unconscious for a while, in the shadow, we suddenly realize that this is just the reflection of all the stuff in collective consciousness. That in fact, it's not us either. There are aspects of it which are us, just as there are aspects of collective consciousness which are us. But this is not where it is. This is that stage in the prodigal son, where the prodigal son finds himself in the piggery, feeding the pigs because he doesn't have any money left anymore, because he spent all his inheritance on wine, women, and song after he left his wealthy father and the life he had been led to live. And suddenly here he is in the piggery and there's a famine in the land, and he suddenly realizes, my father's pigs eat better than I do, you know. And he suddenly goes back home. He suddenly realizes that this isn't him either. He went to find himself, and he found that which deviated from what he was brought up to be, and it wasn't him either. And he goes back to try to find himself at this point. Now, the interesting thing about that is, if there's too much psychic energy now in the personal unconscious, the archetype is going to begin to valence stuff that brings us out of the personal unconscious into something else. And what's that going to be? Well, it's not going to be collective consciousness, because we've already been there. So collective consciousness is not where we're going to go. We're in the personal unconscious. So the only alternative left is the collective unconscious. And that is basically back to the beginning. In other words, back before we ever started making any choices as to who to be, either consciously or unconsciously. Back to the you are material, back to the ground of our being, back to the ground of all being, back to the ground of what all human beings are. There's just one problem with that, and the problem with that is that there's nothing there that translates in any way into the world of consciousness. There's nothing there that consciousness can grasp. There are no words in our lexicons, in any languages, to talk about what's in the collective unconscious. It is an area of pure, disembodied potential. Unactualized potential. It's, if you want to look at it, God. So, in order to get there, we have to have some sort of mediating image to make it to that point. And Jung said, this is the soul image. And the soul image mediates between the ego and the collective unconscious in the same way that the persona mediates between the individual ego and the collective consciousness. So that the man's anima and the woman's animus are the counterparts inwardly of the persona outwardly. It's how we get in touch with the pure potential of humankind. That which everyone is born with, all the archetypal potential we all have when we're born, in order to get in touch with that stuff, we do it through an image. And Jung said, for the man, the image is of the woman. For the woman, the image is of the man. Probably the best early book written on animus and anima was written not by Carl Jung, but by Emma Jung. And if you're not familiar with Emma Jung, Emma was a real crackerjack. She was as smart as Carl, and she bankrolled him. For those of us who wonder how Carl ever managed to devote so much time to his unconscious while he married wealth. Smart guy. Emma bankrolled all this stuff. He didn't have to have a practice. You know, we hear about the 4 years of creative illness and we think, how am I going to fit this in with my need to put food on the table? You know, well, Carl didn't have that problem. You have to understand, you know, Carl was able to do that. But Carl believed, and this is to his credit, that he couldn't just sit back and let it all happen. He worked like a dog at trying to figure out what it was all about. And basically, he went into areas of knowledge, for example, alchemy, that nobody else had the option of doing. But Emma was a very intelligent woman. And the book Anima Animus, I think, is not only one of the best early things ever written on it, but one of the best things ever written on it. We can't really get into that. That's a whole workshop in its own of anima and animus. They're very important, but one of the things I would just want to say to you is that when we become caught up in our animas or in our animuses or our animi and our animi, for those of you who know Latin, however you want to do it, when we get caught up in it, it's important to understand that those images are developmentally oriented, that when we first get caught up in them, there is a requirement on our part to see that these images become more articulated, that they become more sophisticated, and that they become more functional in our lives. Now, this is where we get into the real core of Jungian analysis and the real core of what Jung was talking about, because it's at this stage that we get to be like, and I mentioned last night, Abraham on the mountain, talking to God and bargaining him down for the lives in Sodom and Gomorrah. You remember the story where Abraham is looking at Sodom and Gomorrah and God comes and says, I'm eliminating that town. That town is a horrendously sinful place. And of course, the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, the sin, was that they were not hospitable. They did not welcome strangers. And all throughout the Old Testament, and even in the New Testament, in the Middle East today, if you go to the Middle East, whether Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, all three of those cultures / religions require hospitality to the stranger. So when I go to the Gaza Strip, for example, to work there, it's incredible, the hospitality. People open their houses. You know, just whatever they have is mine, this kind of thing. You are to welcome the stranger. Sodom and Gomorrah were not doing that, and that was anathema to God. So God says, I'm getting rid of it. And Abraham turns to God and says, yeah, but you know, what if there are 100 faithful people there? What if there are, you're going to kill 100 good, solid, believing, hospitable people because there are, you know, a number of people who are not? And God goes, you're right. Okay. If there are 50, I will not destroy it if you can find 50. And Abraham says, 50 is a big number. You know, what if there are only 20? You know, you're gonna kill 20 people just because? And God says, okay, 20. All right. He said, if you can find 20, I won't destroy the place. And Abraham says, well, how about 10? You know, he's basically bargaining him down. And God gets down to 10 and he says, below this I will not go. If you can't find 10, I'm destroying the place. And of course, Abraham goes in and he can't. He finds 3 or something like that. And it's a fascinating story of the bargaining that goes on to spare the lives of Abraham and his family. And then, of course, they leave and the town is destroyed. But this is what we have to do with the archetypes. Once we get to the level where we have integrated, which means seen through, understood, begun to put together pretty well, our collective conscious dimension, which is our persona, we've decided, you know, if I really do want to get what I want in the world, this works pretty well, I'm going to keep it. I'm going to continue to do it. So I'm going to continue to shake hands, say please, say thank you, hold doors open, you know, this kind of stuff. I'm going to do this stuff because it gets me what I want. Or personas can be even more evolved. You know, if I'm going to be a clergyman, you know, I'm going to dress this way, I'm going to act this way, I'm going to, you know, because people expect that and it facilitates my relations, fine, no problem. And I've been integrated to some degree the personal unconscious, the shadow. I know I have these aspects of my personality in order to live. They need to be at variance with the collective culture at large. No problem. I'll allow them to live. I'm not going to suppress them. That's a part of me. I may every now and then need to leave my family and go off on a trip alone and just find who I am, and I'll do that, you know, whatever it is. You know, it may be at variance, but I'm going to do it. I am not, for example, going to be in my persona at home, and I'm not going to require my family to be in the persona in the home. I'm going to make of my home a place where people can do pretty much what they want. So if the kids want to come to the dinner table at night in cutoffs and a t-shirt without having taken a shower, fine. I don't care. That, you know, if they want to sit in the living room and put their feet on the furniture, fine. I'm not going to have a kind of living room where they can't do that. But I'm going to make damn sure that when they go to other people's houses, they know that they're not to do that. You know, so that at home they can live out the other side, but this is all well integrated. And now the anima is really beginning to call to me. I'm a man, or the animus is really beginning to call to me, I'm a woman. And at this point, it's not a matter of just trying it all out, it's a matter of dialoguing with that figure, as if that figure were a personality, a person, and saying, yeah, you feel that what we really need in our lives right now is to do a solo ascent of Mount Everest. No? And I can understand that, you know, that, and boy, does that appeal to me. But I think I'm going to die. You know, I don't think I can do that. We have to do something else. And you begin to bargain with that. Or if you're a woman, and this is a fairly classic one, although this all gets into cultural stereotypes, and understand that anima and animus are very culturally stereotypical. So you can't just take them as being absolute basic truth. But the woman who now has a family and a couple of kids who've are 4, 6, and 3 decides that what she really needs, what the animus really wants her to do, is to run for public office and to become a senator, you know, because that's what the culture really needs and that's what she needs to. She might want to say to the animus, well, yeah, that would be great. I'd love to do it, but what about the kids? What about my home? You know, are there other things in my life too? Because the problem with the anima and the animus is, they're the interface with the collective unconscious. They're the interface with potential. And actual doesn't compute at all. So actuality, in order to be factored into the equation of living out your potential, has to be factored in by the ego. And the ego has to say to the anima or the animus, great, the potential just sounds wonderful, but this is the reality. What can we do with that? And the paradoxical thing about that is that that's what integrating the anima or the animus is. It's not getting anywhere. It's exercising a certain dynamic. Now, bracket all that, and we're going to get back to the basic synchronic dynamics of everything, because what happens with regard to the psyche, and it's already becoming apparent, is that the ego has the capacity to differentiate, to break things down into component parts, to get a sense of what things are made of. So it is the role of the ego to differentiate. That's what the ego does. And the archetype that gives rise to the ego is the archetype that knows that for the continuity of the species, the survival of the organism, differentiation is absolutely essential. But the unconscious is exactly the opposite. The unconscious is forever homogenizing. The unconscious is forever combining things in ways that consciousness can't understand, just taking everything and making soup out of it. It's like when you make pea soup, and you take the carrots, you chop them up, you take the peas, you take the onions, you take the parsley, and you put it all in, and then after it's cooked a little bit, you run it through the blender. The blender is the unconscious. That's what the unconscious does. The chopping is the ego, getting it all into its component parts. One thing that the unconscious is always trying to assimilate, to homogenize with the rest of the psyche, is the ego. This is key to Jung's theories. So in one sense, that the unconscious is always trying to reach back and grab the ego and pull it back down into the unconscious. What the unconscious wants more than anything else is to run the show. What the ego wants more than anything else is to run the show. And during the first half of life, says Jung, it is our job to develop our egos in a way that it runs the show, that we differentiate ourselves from the other aspects, so that all of this lack of awareness of complexes, different parts of our personality, it's all done in the service of helping the ego to differentiate itself as a differentiating mechanism. Round about midlife, with death on the door, it's important for the ego to go back into all that unconscious stuff and figure out how to live there, because the unconscious stuff is as real as is the conscious stuff. So what basically happens with all these archetypes is that once we begin to form diplomatic relations with our collective unconscious, with all that pure potential that we can be. We're always, I think a lot of us, particularly in midlife, are really having to decide what we're going to do and what we're not going to do, because potential opens up to us. And we really have to decide what we want to take advantage of and what we don't want to take advantage of. We've got just so many years left. So what are we going to do and what aren't we going to do? I can remember about 8 years ago when I really got interested in chaos theory and recognized that there was an enormous tie-in between chaos and Jung. I said to myself, I really need a PhD in math. And I got to the point where I was actually thinking of researching math programs when I said, you're out of your mind. You're just now beginning to stop having dreams where you've got a paper due the next day and you can't get it done and you're in a high state of anxiety. Do you really want to go back to school? But my anima was saying, look, you can do it. Are you kidding? A PhD in math as well as in religion and psych, and you could be you could be the one who could bring to humankind the fire. And end up chained to the rack with an eagle eating your liver, That's what I said, I know the myth. I know the myth. I'm not going, Forget it. So this is where we start talking back. And when we do that, we gain the impression that we've learned something. We gain the impression that we've figured something out and we know how the show is run. That, according to Jung, is the stage of the mana personality. And it's something that I just never hear Jungians talk about. And I think that Jungians never talk about it, especially we analysts, because it's the stage we're all in. We don't want to see it as a stage. We want to see it as the goal. But it's not. It is the last attempt on the part of the unconscious to hold on to the ego by offering it yet another image to identify with. And that's the image of the one who knows a little more than most people, the one who's kind of figured out how it all works. If you want to read about this, it's in volume 7. Pardon me? M-A-N-A. Mana basically meaning power. Oh, I don't have any quotations. I'm really sorry. Pardon me? Volume 7, and the chapter heading is called The Mana Personality. And this basically is the point at which we become convinced that we are wise old men or wise old women. We have wisdom. We have something to teach other people. We know more and we see more than most people. We've figured it out. And the problem, of course, is other people don't see it too. You know, they don't buy into it. And especially not our partners and our kids. You know? Our kids are like, yeah, right. Yeah. They're suddenly pointing out things like, "Hey, you got another gray hair today, Dad, huh?" And it's like, shut up. It's the kind of thing where the unconscious is going to keep hold of us by offering an image to identify with that is not real. And people who are monopersonalities get into a lot of professions that encourage people to be monopersonalities. Doctors, you know, physicians, MDs, monopersonalities. "Doctor, I'm sick. You can heal me." "Yes, I can," you know. Ridiculous. Utterly absurd. And most doctors disidentify with that image pretty quickly, and they realize that they don't have very much power. Or an analyst, a Jungian analyst. Somebody comes, their life is in shambles. They have these dreams. What do they mean? Will I tell them? I don't know what they mean. I don't know what's going on. I basically get paid to have people teach me what the situation is. You know, I don't know. And when I first became an analyst, I didn't quite get the point that I didn't have to know. And I thought I had to know. And it was probably the most difficult years of my life. People would bring in dreams, and I would think, "I'm supposed to know what this means." Nobody knows what dreams mean. They're bizarre. You know, they're absolutely crazy. And only the person who dreams the dream really knows what it means. Or people would come in and, well, eventually I got to thinking to myself, why are people paying me, you know, when I don't really know what's going on? And it's a very humbling thing. That's the point at which the mana personality begins to shake off. And you suddenly realize, sort of as the day begins to dawn, that there is in your psyche not only a series of random archetypal firings, but a design. A design that has in mind exactly what Jung defined as individuation. Which, as I said last night, is the process by which individuals are formed and differentiated, a process of differentiation having for its goal the development of the individual personality as a being distinct from the general collective psychology. Volume 6, 757. And suddenly I realize that in all that I've been trying to do in my life, all the good things I've tried to do, all the positive things I've tried to do, all the times when I have been absolutely beside myself with ignorance and fear, not knowing what to do, that was part of a plan. That was part of a plan that brought me here. I remember the first time I really understood that. I was an analyst. I'd finished my training. It was probably about 5 years after I graduated, sometime around 1986, and the Chicago Board of Education opened up 3 positions to the community and said, anyone who wants to apply for these positions can apply. And a friend of mine who was on the board said to me, "We're not getting any applications. Why don't you apply?" And I said, "Okay, I will." Unfortunately, she told me the day that at 5 o'clock, you could no longer hand in an application. So I had to frantically get an application, run home, type it out, get on the L to go back downtown, and I thought to myself, I know what's going to happen. I know exactly what's going to happen. It's going to be a classic Chicago phenomenon. I'm going to get to the office at 4:59. The secretary, who will be sitting there filing her nails, will have locked the door. And I will say, I've got my application. And she will look up at me as if I couldn't care less. And I thought, I should have brought my gun. I should have brought the gun. You know, I'll kill her. And then I thought, maybe that's a message. Maybe that's the point. If I get there, I said, if I get there, and the door is locked, I'm going to bow to this woman. If it's 4:58, I'm going to say thank you. Thank you for locking the door, because this clearly was not meant to be. And then all of those times in your life when you didn't make it, when you failed, when your hopes were dashed, when you wanted one thing and got another, you look back on it and it forms a trail. And it forms a trail right up to where you are at the moment, and you suddenly realize that the trail goes on from there, and you don't know where it goes, but something inside you does. And Jung called that the self. And he said, the only adequate image that we have to carry the archetypal power of that element in our lives is God. He said, the self is not God. Jung was very clear about this. Jung did not believe that you could take all of religion and reduce it to a psychological dynamic. God, he said, is something entirely different. And God is so completely all in all that we can't even begin to define what God is. But whatever God is, the self is very close to it in terms of how it acts in our own individual lives. And at that point, having suffered the breakdown of the persona, gone into your shadow and played around there long enough, hopefully not to get burned beyond repair, gone into the collective unconscious and made peace, gotten a rapprochement going with your anima or your animus, so that now you're not just prey to all these unconscious forces. And having really figured something out, and the most important thing that you figured out is that you really haven't figured very much out, at that point you connect with the self. And when you connect with the self, that's where individuation really begins to work, because then, as I said, the environment is always shouting at us. But at the point you recognize the self, you begin to really listen. You begin to really hear. And you begin to really understand that the events that occur to you have a meaning. They have a purpose. There's something there that is important for you. And that puts an entirely different slant on things like failure, puts an entirely different slant on things like adversity, an entirely different slant on things like frustration, and an entirely different slant on things like success and triumph and all the things that you really thought you needed in life. And that's the end point, in a sense, of individuation. And at that point, you can enter into any dimension of your personality that you want, anytime you want, because you realize that the whole thing has a usefulness in your life, but only if you are willing to go along with it. So you can indulge your shadow when you're willing to take the consequences. You can indulge your persona when there's something you really need to get, and that's the only way to do it. You can indulge the anima or the animus when you really need a kick, when you really need a charge out of life. You know, maybe you will climb Mount Rainier. Maybe not Mount Everest, but maybe Mount Rainier. Maybe you will sail around the world. Maybe you will take up calligraphy. Maybe you will learn another language. Maybe you will do any number of these things. But it'll be because you want to and you want to have the kick out of it. And if it doesn't work, that's part of the plan. No problem. You no longer have to take personal responsibility for this stuff. You are there to interact with it or not. And secondly, you no longer have to project it onto somebody else. You can recognize it as you. So that if somebody can't do for you what you desperately need, rather than raging against that person, you can begin to look at why you can't do that for yourself and why you need someone else there to do it for you. This lecture doesn't end. You know, I mean, individuation doesn't have an end. So at this point, we've got about an hour left. We're going to take a break in a minute. But if there are any questions right now, go ahead, and then we'll come back and we'll just kick it around and we'll make this lecture part of your individuation.
You talk about the conscious and the unconscious going to great polarity.
What? Hang on. Thanks.
You talk about the conscious and the unconscious going to great polarities.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way of taking a conscious attitude so that the two can cooperate more than fight with each other?
Oh, absolutely. That's the goal of individuation, is to have a conscious attitude where the unconscious becomes your ally, becomes an aspect of your functioning that it contributes to the overall picture. And to do that, you have to give up a lot of your own particular views of how things ought to be. And you also have to understand that there are a lot of previously defined as negative functioning capacities that can do you a lot of good, that can really help you out a lot. So yeah, oh, absolutely. But it starts out in a polarized state, because we start out totally. Now, when we are adolescents and we hit like age 13 and our bodies start to develop and the sex drive is really strong, we have to have all kinds of prohibitions on the expression of that sex drive in our culture. Okay, in our culture, because we haven't finished school yet, and as Erik Erikson said, we have the longest adolescence of any culture in the world. You know, I finished my doctorate and my analytical training at age 35. You know, I mean, come on, that's a long adolescence, you know, not to be in the world actually doing anything, although for 3 years in there I did. So no one ever says to us then, although clergy used to do this in marital counseling, but no one ever takes us aside after we finished school and we're working and said, you know, all that stuff we talked to you about sex and how you really shouldn't do this, that, or the other thing, well, it no longer holds. You know, you've done very well. You find a partner, you can do anything you want. Absolutely anything you want. Sex is fine. It's great stuff. Go have a wonderful time. We still have people who in their marriages or in their intimate relations with others for 16, 17, 18 years, observing the same prohibitions on sex they did when they were adolescents. Well, mustn't do this because that's bad. Mustn't look at that because that, you know. So no one says to us that during this period of time, while you have to restrict yourself, that that time comes to an end. And no one says to us, all of this ego development that you've been doing over the years, you now no longer have to worry about. You can go back and play. You know, you got your degree, you know, you got your business, you got whatever you set out to do, you've accomplished it. You don't have to do it anymore. Go play, enjoy yourself, have fun. We don't do that. Because I don't know about the rest of you, but to me, school was two things. It was an absolutely fascinating enterprise. When I started going to kindergarten and first grade, I absolutely loved it. I mean, to me, it was like the opening up of paradise for the first 5 minutes. And then it was drudgery. You know, they would say to me, okay, I can remember, are you ready for this? This was my first reading lesson. My first reading lesson, the teacher went up to the board, Miss Sims, one of the best teachers I've ever had. She was fantastic. And she wrote on the board, we'd already done our ABCs, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, what's that? What are those words? We didn't know the words of that song, but we realized they were letters. We learned our letters, we got them down, and she wrote on the board about halfway through the year, L, O, O, K. We'd been doing the phonics, you know, the flash thing, and she said, what is this word? And I went, look! And we all went, yeah, look! And she goes, very good, very good. Then she handed us our books, Dick and Jane, right? And there was Sally on the first page, and she was putting on a big pair of her dad's rubbers, you know, and she was going out into the rain. And underneath it said, look. And Miss Sims said to me, because I had been the first to recognize the word, would you like to read this page to us? And I said, yes. And she said, go ahead. And I said, well, one day, Sally decided she was going to go out in the rain. And she's putting on these, and she said, John, are you going to tell us about it, or are you going to read it to us? I went, oh. And I went, look. And she said, very good. And that to me was school for the next 27 years, you know. We'd go into math, and they'd say, okay, this is addition. 1 + 2 = 3. Oh, that makes sense. Okay, and then they would give us 50 of them, you know. Now, this is your homework. Do these. Well, I got it the first time, you know. I didn't need to do it 50 times. So it was an amazing amount of concentration, and nobody, when it was all over, said to me, guess what, you don't have to do that anymore, you know. You did very well, now go play, go have fun, and we don't do that. And that's one of the reasons why there's this huge polarization between conscious and unconscious that doesn't get redressed. It has to be there in the beginning. We got to do it. But it doesn't, we don't get deprogrammed. You know, nobody tells us when it's done. So we've got people who are 65 years old who are doing their jobs the same way they did arithmetic homework in, you know, second grade. I'm ranting. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Who's supposed to tell us that?
Jungian analysts. I don't know. You know, I think it would be good if it was just a part of the culture. You know, I think all the cultural institutions should be saying that. I think the churches should be saying it. I think the schools should be saying it. But, you know, I mean, I sometimes think the whole point of our culture is to produce ants, you know?
Maybe the Olympics won't win.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I think that...
hold it. I got to do the Donahue routine.
Donahue.
Yeah, right.
I think that your psyche produces that answer for you.
Well, yes.
It's just that in our culture, this is noisy, it's inhibited or something. I mean, when I was in school, I was looking for a reason for people being lacking interest in any of the things, and today is depression. You know? I mean, and we mask that with all kinds of entertainment and drugs and even psychotropic drugs. I think they're going to mask all this, but I think the psyche's trying to tell you that you've come someplace and this isn't exactly where you want it to be.
Yeah.
And there's still more, and
yeah,
you need to go back and review this.
Right.
And in fact, in some cases like my own, I found that I made a mistake, and the ego was highly embarrassed by that.
Yeah, right.
And highly reduced and humbled.
Yeah.
And so forth, and it was a big enablement of the unconsciousness at that point. So the ego had to be taught a whole bunch of stuff in order to go back and square that up. But I think our culture really tries to mask that for many people. And also, it's such a psychic shock. I think you alluded to that last night, but it's when you arrive at that point, it can be very, very debilitating to the individual. And the older people, if they arrive at this, I think sometimes I've seen them die.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that it's not just a solution to go back into that, you know. And we had a lecture here one time that somebody warned about that. It's not just a prescription to go back and, you know, jump into this stuff, depending upon how severe it is. But to be prepared, and I think that's one of the real arguments for going to a therapist. I mean, to help you do that in moderation or with guidance.
That's really helpful. That's a helpful response. Thanks. That's a point. Who tells us this? The psyche does tell us this. There's no question about it. Unfortunately, I see an increasing level of disdain for that occurrence in our culture. Now, it could be because I'm just getting older. You know, I'm just getting to the age where, well, nothing's any good, you know, and it's all... But it seems to me that as soon as somebody begins to respond to the psyche's call, which unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, seems to first occur in depression, it gets medicated out of existence. You know, the idea is don't lose a day at work. You know, don't let this stuff interfere with your functioning. If it interferes with your functioning, which is always persona-oriented, then measures need to be taken. It's not good. And, of course, to some degree it is. You know, what do you do if you're immersing yourself in your shadow at the same time you have to earn a living? It can be tough. It can be difficult. But I just think that our culture is systematically eliminating the images of the shadow. It doesn't like the shadow. It wants to get rid of it. It's under tremendous duress. Sometimes, charitably, these things are projected on the right wing. You know, the right wing really wants to get rid of all the shadow and keep us, you know, real good little automatons at our jobs. But you're right, when the call from the psyche comes, you have to respond, and to some degree the later it comes, the worse it is.
Yeah, I'd like to just make one response to that.
Yeah.
There's a real difference between therapists in that regard, and I found it to be remarkable once when I went to an industrial medicine doctor. I mean, you know, this is in a large corporation.
Yeah.
And they didn't respond to, you know, the symptoms or provide a cure for this. And I was actually in management trying to interest them in doing something for people that I was seeing having problems. And it was much later that I learned that their mission was to keep them going. You know, like soldiers in a war, And they could, it's sports medicine too. They'll take guys and keep them in the football game forever, even though they're going to have their leg amputated later.
Right.
And I think our society and court system and many of the therapies that are available are designed around that very same thing, to keep them going. The collective conscious wants to keep everybody working. Even our political system wants everybody out there.
Yeah.
They're even threatening now that retirement is an entitlement. So this is culture.
Well, and correspondingly, I think that when I talk to my daughters and their friends, kids today don't have anywhere near the confidence in their future that I think my parents had and I had when I was trained. And I think people are witnessing over and over again the fact that we're on our own. You know, we used to think that if we were good people who worked well and gave our loyalty to the corporation would respond in kind, and now we realize that's not the case. And I think that brings on a certain amount of the individuation process. Unfortunately, it happens to a lot of men in their 50s when they're laid off. And suddenly, it's like that's the first point at which the persona begins to really not work anymore, and the shadow begins to open up. And by that time, it's a very difficult procedure to do anything about it. But I think that's somewhat of a hopeful sign, the idea that great mother institution in business no longer exists, and we're much more on our own. And I think the whole distribution of work among men and women now is a very healthy, good thing. Men are able to do roles they never were able to do, and women are able to do roles they were never able to do. The only problem that I'm seeing is that now it's getting to the point where both have to work full-time in order to keep a family alive, and there's no time left over for anything like individuation. And it's just a kind of an unconscious process of just trying to keep house and home together over and over again until finally either everything falls apart or you die. And there's a very core piece of individuation that can't get confronted. And I think the kids are recognizing that, and in adolescence, to me, it's no mystery at all why kids turn to drugs. You know, drugs are the only reliable thing in their environment. They're the only things that deliver what they promise. Now, of course, a lot comes along with it that necessarily maybe was not promised, and it can be very difficult, but drugs give you what they say they're going to give you. And so we have a whole culture that's fascinated with the idea of saying to kids that drugs are false and they lie and all of this kind of stuff, which when you're on the other side of it, you can tell is really true, but it doesn't work going in because the kids know you're wrong. You know, it's amazing. And what do they deliver? They deliver the very transformation that our whole culture doesn't know how to do. You know, it doesn't know how to give us that. And school doesn't know how to give us that. It doesn't compute anymore that if you go to school, you can build a life for yourself. It just doesn't compute. You can go to school, graduate at the top of your class in high school, go to college, graduate at the top of your class, go to grad school, get a PhD at the top of your class, and not have a job. Huh? There's a real breakdown in the system there. So the old ways of transforming ourselves have kind of, just like when Jung said symbols lose their archetypal power and become just empty signs, it's happening a lot. But drugs don't do that. They deliver what they promise. And there's big problems with that, but the problem is not whether they're false or not. We should take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish up. So think of the questions you have or the things you'd like to hear a little more about, and when you come back, we'll wrap it up. That may help you, it may not. It's something that I just came up with a couple of years ago to try to make it a little clearer what the whole structure of the psyche was. If you want to read more about this, really the place to go is Volume 8 and Volume 7. That's where Jung talks about a lot of what we're talking about today. And it's great stuff, and it's a good introduction to some of his more abstruse writings later on about things like alchemy and all of that. This is the Titanic, yes, of course, and it really... I used to put this in just as a joke, but then I discovered people were coming up with all kinds of fantasies about what part of the psyche this was, you know. And so, as you wish. clearly the idea here is that this, one of the few symbols that Jung said really, one of the few images that Jung said really means about the same thing every time it appears, is the ocean, is the sea, which he felt was really symbolic of the unconscious no matter when it appeared. So when we have those dreams where we're walking on the beach and the ocean is here and the land is here, you know, that's sort of like the interface between consciousness and the unconscious. The ego and consciousness, the light of consciousness, so to speak, is above the level of the water. The persona is the interface between this and the surround, as is the anima and the animus, the interface with this and the surround. And this is the surrounding environment of consciousness. So this is collective. This is collective consciousness out here. This is collective unconsciousness down here. And of course, collective unconsciousness, as you know, icebergs underwater are in a constant state of flux. You know, there's constant melting and refreezing going on with the water. So the interface between one's, if we can use this kind of an idea, our collective unconscious and the collective unconscious, basically this is the part of our own psyches which extends into everything else. And that's what gives rise to things like the idea of synchronicity, that we are in some ways all connected, and that if one of us changes one element in the field, the whole field changes. Because this again, to try to sort of skew the metaphor a little bit and use words that are probably relatively paradoxical, and of course I think paradox is closer to truth than not, to say my collective unconscious is that aspect or that interface with collective unconscious that I experience connects me with the collective unconscious of everyone else. You know, we are all at this level connected. The shadow is the counterpart of the ego and consciousness under the surface of the water here, the interface between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious as the entire personal psyche, this is the personal psyche, with the collective psyche is through the anima, animus, if it's unconscious, through the persona, if it's conscious.
Who would you draw in the complexes?
The complexes. Well, the complexes really are kind of, they're almost on this interface too, because there are aspects of the complexes that are clearly individual, those personal experiences that we've had that then become the associations of the complex. But they're also archetypal. That's the core. That's what gives the complex its coherence, is the archetype. And that coherence is felt as a feeling. We experience it as a feeling. So the complexes would be kind of like just dotted around in here. Complexes are really a function of the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. But to the degree, then, that we are aware of the associations, the stuff of the complex becomes part of the ego. So it's the ego's role constantly to be peeling stuff off the complexes and bringing it into an association with consciousness. And of course, where you can't do that is when you get deeply enough into the complex that you're close to the archetype and the collective unconscious, because none of that stuff translates. Which is kind of a fun idea. Playing with these ideas a little bit is a lot of fun in terms of dreams. I'm sure you've all had the experience where you're having an extremely vivid dream, and you actually even kind of know you're dreaming. But everything in the dream is crystal clear, and you know exactly what's happening. And you wake up, and you cannot recall a thing. You know, well, if you're having a truly archetypal dream, then it would not translate into consciousness at all. But you'd be familiar with it. In other words, your psyche, your unconscious, which is doing the dreaming, which would be totally conversant with this stuff. But there's nothing in the language to represent it on paper or in the mind, so you can't do anything with it. Correspondingly,
wouldn't symbols have that function?
That function of representing?
That
sure.
Function?
Sure, symbols would definitely have that function, yeah. But a symbol, remember, is a combination of form, which is the archetype, and content, which comes from the world. But anything in the collective unconscious would not correlate with anything in the world. So there wouldn't be any kind of symbol attached to that, in the sense that we know symbols as having a content that's recognizable. It would simply be a power. We would just simply feel the power. Because what is in the collective unconscious is not materia, it's potential, it's not actual. So there's nothing there to present other than potential. And potential cannot be represented in anything other than actual. And if it's represented in actual, it's not potential anymore. So that's the thing you run into with stuff that comes up out of the collective unconscious, is it just does not translate.
Well, then what is the symbol of, say, a mother symbol of the mother archetype? What is that?
There's no such thing as the mother archetype.
All right, can you give me one if there isn't?
There isn't. This is where it gets real abstruse and real tough to understand. The question was, where does the stuff come for the symbol of the mother archetype? What we loosely refer to as the mother archetype is a dynamic that puts the ego in touch with a certain category of experience. Those who tend to embody that which comes closest to those categories or that category of experience are, first of all, our mothers. So you can speak of the archetype of which mothers are one part. Say, but it's impossible to designate the archetype itself, because you can only designate the archetype by referring to one of its parts.
Okay. It is almost the same as discussing God, the essence of life, as opposed to the...
Yeah, right.
We can see it.
Absolutely. Same dilemma. Yeah, same dilemma. Right. So when people talk about the mother archetype, it's shorthand. And unfortunately, it then gets confused with images. This is something that happens all the time with regard to Jungians, is that the archetype is confused with the image. The archetype is not the image. And this is why Jung says, if you want to interpret symbols, you have to look at the manifestation of the image in all of its manifestations and draw your conclusion from that if you want to get an idea of what that archetype is about. So those of you who have symbol dictionaries, you can look up something like bear. You know, and of course we know that bears appear in myths, they appear in folk tales, they appear in movies, they appear in novels, they appear in zoos, they appear in beds. You know, there are teddy bears, there are, you know, all kinds of bears. And then from there, you can go to the symbol dictionary and find out what the bear means in Chinese mythology, what the bear means. And as you get all of that together, all of that will, to some degree, approach what that archetype is about. And as soon as you specify it, you've lost the meaning, which is what's so frustrating, you know, because one of the wonderful things about Freud was he was, to some degree, reductionistic. To some degree, he saw beyond that. But it was possible to say, oh, well, this symbol means this. Your dream means this. And whereas in Jungian psychology, the point of dream analysis is to stretch consciousness beyond its categories, not to bring something unconscious into the glare of consciousness. It's not a mining expedition. It's not imperialism. It's not retrieving something and bringing it up. It's getting the ego to be comfortable with dwelling in a land where its categories don't apply.
For what purpose?
Adaptation. The ego that can dwell comfortably in an environment where its categories do not apply will be an ego that's more highly adapted. It can adapt to different environments much more easily than the ego that has to hold on to its categories, that can only discern through categories.
I thought dream work was also the same as in Freudian, where it was to become more conscious. It was a tool to bring more that is unconscious conscious. That's not true.
It is true. It's a two-way street. Yeah, it is true. I think what becomes most conscious in dream analysis is the limitations of consciousness and the perceiving power of the unconscious. a power of perceiving which is generally communicated to us, as is all archetypal stuff, affectively. So to some degree, dream analysis is to help us to be more comfortable processing through our feelings. And the problem with processing through our feelings is most of us are not very sophisticated at it. So what gets processed is usually very basic, rudimentary stuff that isn't necessarily adaptive. But for example, if you decide to travel to China, yeah, where you don't understand the language and you don't understand the customs and you don't understand the food and you don't understand anything, you've never seen it before, it's foreign to you, if you are more comfortable in environments where your categories don't apply, you'll have a much better time in China. And the people in China will find you much more approachable, and you will actually interact more than if you had categories. Right? And that's why I said last night, this is what I think basically is true of death as well. You know, at the moment we die, one of two things is going to happen. Either there will be nothing, at which point there's no problem, or we will enter into an environment, an experience that's radically different from this, where our categories may not apply. And if we're comfortable with that, it'll be a pleasanter place.
So all this is an effort to be comfortable when we die.
Pardon me?
Yeah. I said all this is an effort to be comfortable
with. Absolutely. Yes, yes. It's like life insurance, you know, is it right? Yeah.
Yeah. For the next day.
Right, right.
Yeah. Last time we talked a little bit about the relationship between these personal structures, psychic structures, and collective events or collective evolutions.
Right.
And I'm curious, I think you commented at the time that the monotheistic ego of the last 2,000 years is exhausting its usefulness. What is your vision of what is another relationship to these structures that is more viable?
Well, I'm a real, if we're going to talk about religion, I'm a real devotee of David Tracy. I don't know if you're familiar with David Tracy, but I think he's one of the premier theologians of our day. He's at the University of Chicago, of course, you know, true to my alma mater here. But he writes a lot about pluralism, and he has a very interesting book out called Pluralism and Ambiguity. And he believes that those are the two key constructs for the church, and if we're going to talk about, you know, the monotheism and what's going, the churches are to some degree the ones that are supposed to be on the cutting edge of helping us to assimilate all of that stuff, that pluralism and ambiguity are going to be the two biggest challenges that the churches will have to face in the coming years. And by pluralism, he means learning from other religions. Basically, coming into contact with other religions, not to convert, but to learn from and to share what we have too. And I think that's already well established in virtually all the religions that I've had contact with. There are many, many people who in terms of the idea of converting, that's the last thing in their mind. The idea is to share information, almost like fellow explorers in the same territory to tell what we've seen so that everyone gets a better sense of the lay of the land. So that's happening. And he says, but as that happens, there's going to be an increase in ambiguity. And he feels that ambiguity is really closer to the reality of what religion is dealing with than any of the specificities that we've come up with. He's a Catholic theologian, and he's a Catholic priest. And he wrote another book called Blessed Rage for Order, which is just a fabulous, fabulous book. So if you want to continue with this stuff, read David Tracy. He's really wonderful. And if you ever get a chance to hear him, he's one of those people who combines, he's kind of known at the University of Chicago as the person you don't want to teach a course with, because what he loves to do is teach a course in like theology and history of religions, or theology and philosophy of religion. He and Paul Ricoeur teach, I don't know if you've heard of Paul Ricoeur, but he's a very well thought of philosopher these days. Fabulous, fabulous mind. And the two of them will teach together. And the problem is that if you are, for example, in the history of Christianity and you teach a course with David Tracy, within 3 weeks he knows more about the course than you do. You know, he knows more about your field than you do. The man's mind is absolutely unbelievable. And yet he's a gentle, loving, wonderful person. You know, he's not that sort of that you sort of identify with that sort of stuff. So if you ever get a chance to, he's wonderful. But plurality and ambiguity, I think, is where we have to go. Wait, I'm sorry. Wait, this is a good comment. As was that, but we forgot to give you the microphone.
You get the idea that in order to get where we might want to go, we have to educate the ego, get it used to being in unfamiliar places and tolerant of ambiguity, maybe even receptive to and embracing of chaos. And my question is, we have this basic human equipment, our limitations. Our ego likes things to be in a certain construct, and it loves to create structures. And
right.
And those are the very things, of course, that make it very hard for us to tap this vast energy in this collective unconscious.
Right.
Yes. So do you have any words of wisdom beyond the usual spiritual traditions, which is you practice, 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 and you meditate, 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 and you do whatever you can to basically get a more pliant ego that will allow the energy to flow?
Yes, there are some good things. First, one book you might want to read is James Hillman's book, Revisioning Psychology, because this is what he talks about.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. I think it's the best. I like it the best of everything he's written. So Revisioning Psychology is a good place to start. I think what the ego needs to do more than anything else is to avail itself of the perspectives at its disposal. You know, for example, in Revisioning Psychology, Hillman says this one phrase that I just love. The wound is the I. You know, and that's great. You know, that's really nice. That helps so much. For years now, when people have come to me who are not sure if they were sexually abused in childhood, I've been saying to them, we're not going to be concerned here whether it happened or not. We're going to be concerned with what that metaphor teaches you, where it takes you, what the wound, if it's whatever wound is there, it's less important what caused it than what it sees. Let's see what it sees. So the ego, which loves to form structure and loves to form ideas, and you know, my God, that's exactly what we've been doing here, right? I mean, everything I've been doing is giving you structure and ideas that say, you know, structure and ideas are not where we need to go. I mean, it's, you know, it's a little bit odd, but, you know, that is how we think. But there are so many perspectives out there that we can have access to if we will allow ourselves to accept the fact that they're authentic. And for everybody in this room, I suspect, dreams are considered to be authentic. But for the population at large, this is not the case. If anything, dreams are a kind of interesting thing that happen every now and then, and sometimes we remember a dream and even tell somebody about it, but we don't really know what it means, and besides, we've got to get to work. You know, you know how it is when you first start to write down your dreams, and it's like, do I have to get up earlier to do this? You know, when do I write them down? And people come into analysis all the time and say, I had this great dream, but, you know, by the time I got to work, I'd forgotten it. You know, well, you know, of course, obviously. And that's kind of the way we look at dreams. But just to accept the idea that the other 8 hours of the day that we are asleep, there's something going on. And that something going on is not simply gibberish, begins to get us connected to other perspectives. Now, of course, we're going to take our structure and fit in the structure and all that, but the beautiful thing about our structures is they have to evolve as the data that is assimilated evolves. So eventually, the structures do become more sophisticated. They do become more able to accommodate more types of views. So that's what I would suggest. And it's not just practice, practice, practice. It's play, play, play. You know? It's play with it. And that's the most important thing about dreams, is to play with them. Some people come into Jungian analysis and they're so serious, you know. I don't know, this dream, you know, it reminds me of this myth. And I'm practically asleep before, you know, they're 5 minutes into what the dream means because they're, you know, because I don't like that stuff.
I'm curious about the mono-personality.
Yes.
The mono personality as a gateway or a sidetrack? What function or what purpose does it serve the individual?
That stage of the mono personality. I think that's the most important part of the mana personality stage. Is it's the stage at which we really have to accept the fact that we are not running the show. To the degree that we learn along the way about our persona, shadow, anima, animus, that we're not running the show, it's in the service of increasingly running the show. The mana personality is that point at which we realize that running the show is a shared endeavor between the ego and the unconscious, and that it's the dialogue between ego and unconscious that's really the key, and not the idea that we go along with what's in the unconscious or we go along in the ego, but that the two enter into an ongoing give and take. And that's true for dream analysis. Again, dream analysis, the point is really not so much to understand the dream, but to enter into a dialogue with it, which is why we keep dream journals, so that you can see the dialogue unfold as it goes along. Just to give some feedback to the unconscious. And Robert Johnson, in his book Inner Work, talks a lot about the ritualizing of dreams and how important that is. And Jung felt that too. He felt that it was an ethical issue of what to do with dreams. And once you get into contact with a dream image, what do you do with it? Well, Jung said you elaborate it. You bring it into your environment as much as possible. Johnson says you construct some sort of a ritual. You do something with it. Frequently I'll say to somebody who has a dream image of something, find a representation of that image. You know, if they dreamed of a turtle, you know, find a turtle. The next time you see a turtle, get that turtle. If you're walking by a store window and they have a little stone turtle, buy it. If you're leafing through a magazine, you see a turtle, rip it out, you know, and keep it with you. Put it someplace where you're going to see it, as if to say to the unconscious, I get it, there's a turtle. I don't get it all, but I know there's a turtle, you know, and I'm connecting to turtle. And the unconscious will elaborate that. It'll say, oh, okay, you got that. Well, how about this? And the dialogue comes along. Now, the mana personality is the person who wants to be in charge of the dialogue, see? And it's very seductive because we all want somebody to be in charge of the dialogue. I mean, this country is longing for a politician who really knows what's going on. You know, because we certainly don't. And there are any number of people who are willing to identify with that projection. And what automatically happens when they do that is it starts to break down. You know, I was, you know, kind of alluding to Newt Gingrich last night, and I will reiterate here that I love Newt Gingrich. You know, I don't like anything he says, but I really like the fact that there's a guy who is as blustery and as extroverted intuitive as I am, you know, and he's a real monopersonality at this point. But his sister is a lesbian. I don't know if you know that. So Newt's attitudes towards the homosexual community are very much at variance with all those people who are claiming him as their own. Now, this kind of discontinuity, which is created by the fact that this guy, no matter how much he feels he knows what's going on and how things should be, and how much other people want him to carry that projection, there are complicating factors in his life that do not allow him to do that. So, pride goeth before a fall is a way of saying that the more we identify ourselves as actually knowing what's going on, the greater is the potential for us to find out otherwise. See. I don't know if that answers.
That clears something
else. Okay.
I've had to go back and think about your opening last night, which you talked about holding these opposites in attention.
Right.
And my experience of that is that it resolves itself in the transcendent function. In other words, that was the understanding I had. But I got confused here about reaching back into the unconscious to come up with something out of there, you know, that was going to emerge. I don't think it really comes out of there. It only comes out as the transcendent function. You know, if you can hold the conscious mind against the unconscious long enough, this transcendent function emerges.
Right.
And my question is, in that context, you know, the transcendent function, which is not really talked about all that much, but where the growth is, that the mana personality to me, at least at the stage where I am, seems to be a person that's accumulated a lot of transcendent function experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could also be, you know, considered like what you're talking about, but I would view a false mana personality as a inflated ego, you know, or this prideful.
Well, the man of personality is the inflated ego. No question. That's a good definition of it. The man of personality is the inflated ego. It's identifying itself with stuff that's far greater and more extensive than it is. And it's identifying with that.
The inflated ego, in a sense, though, doesn't respect where the source of that was, you know, I mean.
Right.
I've seen, like, the wise old man in Indian lore and a few other things where it really seems to be egoless, but truly a transcendent individual, you know, or at least it's speaking from that platform. So, but I think it's easy to err into this inflated ego, and it's seductive. And people want to maybe arrive there. Maybe that's a goal, a life goal or something.
Well, certainly our culture loves the ego, you know, and we really do believe that the ego can figure everything out. We really do believe that every problem has a solution. You know, the Niebuhrian idea that every solution is its own problem. You know, is the father is the progenitor of a new problem, is often lost on people who want to find solutions to things. The poor you have always with you, you know. Interesting little gospel phrase. What does that mean? You know, and what does it mean intrapersonally, intrapsychically? What does it mean culturally? You know, what's that whole point? So, yeah, the whole idea of the heroic ego, you know, the Apollonian ego, the ego that can really master things, is where the man of personality really comes into its own, because it feels it has done that. And it is. It's a transition stage then into recognizing that that's not the case. And probably the most important antidote to the mana personality, as I said earlier, is the community and the community around us. As Jung said, every inflation causes an alienation. Every time we get inflated, we become alienated from those around us, and those around us know it, and they avoid us. They, you know, they try to knock us down, you know. Just imagine, I mean, if I were to say to myself and say to my anima, which fortunately she isn't screaming this in my ear, but if she were saying, you should run for president, you know, what's the first thing that's going to happen if I declare myself for the presidency? My handlers are going to take me aside for 3 hours and say, is there anything in your history, you know, did you ever sleep with another woman besides your wife? Did you ever do this, that, or the other thing? Because as soon as I put myself up there as the projection carrier, everybody's going to look for the shadow, you know, and it'll be there. It'll be there. And then everybody can say, oh, well, it's not him, you know. It's always there. And I think our culture is now just becoming aware of it. I mean, the voter has to be realizing before very long that the people they're looking for to run don't exist. You know, as we used to say in the 60s, if they want to run, we don't want them to be there. You know, that was the old idea. But that has now evolved into the fact that we are all humans and we really don't know what's going on. And there's a tremendous amount of waste and a tremendous amount of mistakes. And that's just the way it is. You know, that kind of stuff. So the voters will keep, you know, going through, you know, group after group after group until they finally find what they're looking for, but it won't be there. You know, term limits is I'm sorry, I'm raving again. You know, I get onto this. I think term limits is one of the funniest things I've ever heard of. You know, I just love the idea of term limits. You know, please, somebody save us from the choices we've made. You know, the voters have finally decided that they're too stupid to elect the right person, so please, let's pass a law. You know, it's like, wait a minute. Do you realize what you're saying? Yeah, right, the chess clock. Yeah, right. We got the
You had said that one of the first calls from the psyche was in the form of depression, and I was wondering
of
depression.
Depression.
And I was wondering if you had any ideas as to why that might be.
Oh, okay. I think that the reason that the first call from the psyche comes through as depression is because the call from the psyche usually occurs when there is an overbalance in our connectedness to the environment, as opposed to our connectedness to ourselves, and an overly extroverted attitude. And as Jung said, in the first half of life, whether we are by disposition introverts or extroverts, we have to be extroverts. we have to be relating to the environment. We have to be relating to the other. We have to get an education. We have to get a job. We have to get our lives together. We have to get a partner. We don't have to, but in many thought structures, that's there. We have to somehow get our lives going by interacting with the surround. Now, when the psyche calls us to become aware of what's greater or what more there is than just ourselves and the environment, in other words, the internal environment, we have to withdraw energy from the environment and internalize it. We have to direct our intention inward. And to do that, we become what is defined in this culture as depressed. See? And I think that depression could almost be looked at as a kind of European-American invention. You know, depression does not exist in all cultures in the way we think of it. Now, there is some thought with serotonin, if in doubt, call it serotonin, but actually this is really coming out, that there are biochemical depressions where people just lack a certain chemistry to allow them to be as connected as they would like to be. We're not really talking about that. Most cultures have provisions for people to go through systematic depressions. They're called rituals. They're called meditation. They're called prayer. They're called retreats. They're called initiation rites. You know, for a culture that doesn't have those, then it's going to have to just kind of be spontaneous. You know, the question of how do we know when we've got to turn inside and all of that? Well, it happens. The psyche calls us, and then we go. If you live in a culture that has systematic provisions for doing that, then it doesn't have to be that way. Because, I mean, it is that way, but there's a place for it in the culture. When I lived in Jamaica, depression was... When I was in Gaza a couple times ago, the guy who was the administrator of the mental health program that I work in went to school at the University of Memphis, and he was talking about Gaza society and American society, and there was a Belgian guy there too, and the three of us were talking, and you know what it's like to live in Gaza, and the administrator said, in many ways, he said, I think it's a lot easier to live in Gaza than it is to live in the United States. And the Belgian guy was like, you must be out of your mind, what are you talking about? And he said, in Gaza, if you want to take a year off and just sort of think things over, you can do it. Your family will take care of you. There's enough food to go around. There's nowhere you can really go anyway because the borders are closed. And there really aren't any businesses. There's no real profession you can enter into. There's no way you can really develop your life anyway. So, if you want to back off, that's perfectly okay. He said, but in the United States, if you wanted to take a year off and think about things and just not do anything, you'd probably be medicated. So different cultures have a place for this, and we really don't. We really don't. And I think one of the reasons we don't is not because we are hostile to it necessarily, but because for most people in this country, it is a tremendously exciting thing to be ego-involved. Tremendously exciting to be doing one thing after another, and to be enjoying all these various things. But I don't know about analytical practices in Seattle, but in a lot of places they're way up. I mean, we're busy people, and there are a lot of people who aren't fitting into that somehow. So I don't know. I mean, for me the movement from extroversion to introversion was a very painful process that I didn't want to do because I loved being extroverted. I really just adored it. It was just wonderful stuff. I didn't have a clue as to what introversion was. But I can remember as a child lying in my backyard, on my back, looking up at the clouds, doing nothing for like hours at a time, and loving that time and wishing I could do it again. So there was a call. Pardon me? Lent is definitely that kind of a ritual. I have basically been doing workshops for years on Lent as a wilderness experience, but that's the point. In Lent, you go back into the wilderness where there is nothing, just you and God, and how important that is. Yeah, Lent is. But again, how many people observe Lent? well, I'll give something up.
Not even very many Christians.
Right.
Really.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely not. I mean, how many Christians have been on a silent retreat? No?
I've got a theory that, especially in our culture, you know, the adaptation, you know, collective consciousness value of adaptation, you know, being so extremely important is what keeps us from going into these rituals. In other words, we don't see the ritual as being an adaptive process in itself, which I believe it is.
Yeah.
But the culture doesn't know that.
Right.
And so they look at everybody like a soldier does, you know, that when you're in battle, you don't mourn the death of your friend who was just standing next to you or worry about him or anything, because you realize you have to go to an objective and use all this concentration and ability to do that task. I mean, there's no...
Right.
You can't even waver a moment or it's all over for you. And so what I say is you defer this ritual or you defer this energy someplace. And for me, I know that deferral came at a very high cost because after a while, the deferral, you get out of touch with it, you know, totally. And
it does for most people. Usually what happens is a physical symptom. That's what
Yeah, something eventually comes along and forces you into this. And I think the debilitation at that time is worse than going through the ritual at the time, if you could possibly do it.
I'll have to ask my wife about this. I don't know what the actual statistics are, but it seems to me that I'm hearing of men having heart attacks at younger ages. I don't know if that's the case, but and I think a heart attack is a really symbolic thing of what's going on. There's an inherent prejudice, and it's a political prejudice, that underlies a lot of what I've been talking about here, and I think I should get it out in the open so people can address it and understand that some of what I'm talking about is being psychological stuff, maybe actually my political views. But my impression of the world is that the first world, as opposed to the third world, is no longer geographically defined. That the first world is becoming, as a guy said, this, I didn't get this from myself, I got it from a man who spoke at the conference in the Philippines again from Australia. He said the first world are the first class waiting lounges for airplanes and the first class sections of airlines, the luxury hotels. He said the first world is a transnational category now, as is the third world. And I think that what's happening in our country is that we're systematically being pushed into the third world, because it's highly profitable to the new first world, which is transnational, multinational. So that's important for you to understand. And I think that's a lot of what I see is going wrong with this country, I think, has a lot to do with that, because so much gets back to how many days can you take off of work, you know, to do this sort of thing. That's the first thing I want to say, so that you know what my prejudice is. The last thing I want to do is read to you a shadow dream. It's a kind of a fun dream that was presented to me by a young man who was, well, I was in the Diocese of Chicago, as I said, for 20 years, which is a very Anglo-Catholic diocese, which means it's very much like the Roman Catholic Church. And this guy was an Episcopalian, he would call himself an Anglican, who was frustrated not so much with the Episcopal Church, which he felt was not high church enough, but with the Roman Catholic Church, because he really wanted to be a Roman priest, but the Roman Church had sold its birthright. It had given up all of this stuff. So he was in a real hard situation trying to figure out what to do, and he had grown up with a very abusive father, the kind of father who would take him to the swimming hole, and then when they'd come back from the swimming hole, and he'd be changing out of his bathing suit into his clothes. As soon as he had his bathing suit off and was in the car and was getting his clothes, the father would start the engine and drive off and force the kid to run naked down the road after the car. You know, I mean, really, a son of a bitch type dad. And this guy had the following dream. He was thinking about becoming ordained as a Roman priest, and this was the dream he had. In my front room, I discovered a bishop wearing a mitre and small, beady, dark sunglasses. He seemed to be applying what might have been chrism on the inner wall of the room. I assumed he was performing a house blessing. Interesting opening statement, you know, for this guy. In the next scene, he was in my living room and had taken apart the pump organ and was applying the same stuff to the footboard and pedals of the instrument. The material had the consistency of paint thinner. I walked into my bedroom, and as I walked down the hall, I encountered my bathroom cabinet from under the sink torn apart and strewn in the way. In the bedroom, I discovered a man, a woman, and an infant sleeping in my bed. I was already angry at the damage done to the rest of the house, and I wanted everyone out. I demanded that these people in my bed get out, but in a certain sense of kindness, said that the baby, whose head was rather large and had somewhat oversized protruding bluish veins on the top, could stay there sleeping. The next thing I know, the two of them are behind my chair in the corner of the room, and when I demand that they leave, the man brushed several decanters and glasses onto the floor that were sitting on top of my stereo speaker in back of the chair. They leave the room, and I follow them down the hall and threw them out the door. We had to wade through the destruction of wood and glass in the hallway to get to the door. After they left, I slammed the door shut and started to retreat. Then I decided that that hadn't quite been enough, and I reopened the door, stepped out, took the man's glasses off his face, and slammed them into the wall, shattering them completely. I went back inside, closed the door, and the dream ended. Now, the interesting thing to me about this dream is that this really woke the guy up. You know, he was like, he had no idea that he was this angry and this violent and about all of this stuff. And one of the things that he picked up on right away was the bishop in the beginning of the dream with small, beady, dark sunglasses. And what would that tend to symbolize? Well, it symbolized for this guy the vision of the church, which had been sort of skewed into the new trendy type stuff. And the end of the dream, where there's this man who is the husband, supposedly, of this woman, who's and they're both the parents of this child, and he rips his glasses off and slams them into the wall. And of course, the question was, what was his perspective that he was systematically doing this to? What part of him was this? And it was just a fascinating example of a shadow dream, a kind of wake-up call. And the guy got really serious at that point about the analysis. And as a result of which, he eventually went off to Switzerland, where he attended the seminary that was run by the bishop, who was so reactionary in the Roman Church that he had been relieved of his duties by the Pope and became the first man in all of us who were in Chicago and knew this guy, first guy in our memory who was ordained and suppressed on the same day. He was ordained, and of course he couldn't practice because the whole seminary was out. So I just wanted to share that dream with you as an example of the kind of thing we're talking about here and as an ending to our day. We have 1 minute left. Is there anything that you need something further on that you really need to have clarified, or anything that you've been sitting here wanting to say this whole time and haven't really had your chance to, and you'd like to do it now? Have a good weekend. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.